Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The march to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act continues in Washington, with Governor Kasich repeatedly warning that major ramifications are at hand for Ohioans. We're talking about that and more today on our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Joining us, Ohio State House Bureau Chief for Gatehouse Media, Mark Kovac. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi.
Is that the right title now?
Well, I guess I'm not. I'm just a reporter now.
Okay.
So I'm still figuring it out.
Okay.
But I still work for the Vindicator, too.
So. All righty. And from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Andy Chow. Welcome, Andy.
That title is correct.
Okay. Yep. And joining us in a few minutes, Daryl Rowland, Public Affairs Editor for the Columbus Dispatch. For now, it's just the three of us. The New York Times published an op-ed by Governor Kasich on Friday. In it, he argued that a unilateral solution didn't work for the Democrats with the Affordable Care Act, and that a unilateral solution won't work for the Republicans now when it comes to repeal and replace. Is he trying to call for bipartisanship now, Mark Kovac?
Well, Kasich's been trying to call for some level of bipartisanship for a while. Wasn't he the reasonable presidential candidate kind of going through the system saying we got to work together and I've got a proven track record in Congress of balancing the budget and working with Democrats? And
is that what he's really known for, though?
Well, I think.
Or is that what he says he's known for?
He mentions it a lot. So that's what I know him for now, since I hear him say it so often. You know, but I mean, he does have a book coming out next month, and that's kind of the topic of it. You know, he's talking about the increasing polarization of the political parties in this country and where things stand politically. And I think that's kind of his thing at the moment.
Yeah, he hasn't really deviated from the talking points that are probably going to be mentioned in his book. You ask, is he calling for bipartisanship? It'll be interesting to see. Maybe that's kind of the reputation he's looking for on the federal level. But as far as here on the state level with the Ohio General Assembly, the Ohio House, the Ohio Senate, it seems like a different picture here when it comes to the state budget. But it doesn't really seem like that's what Governor Kasich is focusing on right now. He'd rather be on Meet the Press.
Yeah, he's definitely on a lot of news shows. Bipartisanship, though, is that kind of spitting in the wind at this point, Mark?
Seemingly. I mean, we have Donald Trump in the White House, and people are pretty vocal on one side or the other at this point. Polarized, I mean, as Kasich will tell you in his book. So, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Daryl Rowland, Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan said he plans to introduce his own repeal and replace. He's a member of the House Conservative Caucus. That's probably not what John Kasich has in mind.
I think that we have the two polar opposites within the Republican Party in Congressman Jordan from over in Urbana and, of course, Governor Kasich. Congressman Jordan's repeal and replace has heavy emphasis on the repeal part, and there's not a whole lot of replacement, at least that I've seen.
In fact, he's saying repeal it first and then talk about replacing.
Yeah, exactly, okay. Which means, you know, as soon as that would take effect, all of these millions would be cut off that you know you've seen talked about, whereas Governor Kasich, of course, wants to, frankly, preserve parts of Obamacare, and that's anathema to many Republicans, such as Congressman Jordan. But again, the Medicaid expansion we've talked many, many times here in Ohio. 700,000 people have gained coverage through
Most people affected by Obamacare, it's because of the Medicaid expansion in Ohio.
Right. It's about a million overall. So you got 300,000 exchanges. Again, a round number, 700,000 covered by the Medicaid expansion, which frankly is far more than they thought going in. So, you know, you take away the Medicaid expansion as is proposed, then the state has a choice. Do you pay, you know, I think the estimate is at $1.5 billion every year just to cover that population, or do you trim back benefits, or do you start throwing people off the rolls? So either way, and you know, this the context of that development comes in as Ohio's budget outlook is worsening with, you know, the income tax projections or not income tax collections being down, so that's going to affect the budget starting
anyway
in July.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing right now is political rhetoric colliding with actual policymaking here, where the Republicans have been able to say for years now that they want to repeal Obamacare or repeal and replace Obamacare. And I think to a lot of Republican supporters, I think a lot of them figured, well, if we get control of the House, control of the Senate, and control of the White House, there's already a plan in place. that all like and that we can move forward with. And I think right now we're seeing, wait a minute, there, when it actually comes to making policy, there's a lot of division here. Yeah. Well, you do have a Congressman, Jim Jordan, who says, you accepted my bill, what, 2 years ago? It was a straight out repeal.
Right.
Everybody voted for it. Why aren't we doing that right now?
Because that's when back when they were doing symbolic votes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we're talking, I mean, I would just bring up, we're talking then about more than just, you know, going to your doctor's office as opposed to going to the emergency room for care. Kasich will keep hitting on, you know, we're talking about, you know, our opioid epidemic, the drug treatment, the mental health treatment and those things. And so it's not just, okay, we've got all these extra people who are going to be going to emergency rooms or dealing with health care costs. There are other programs and issues that we're dealing with that Medicaid is supporting right now.
Yeah. You know, Daryl, the Dispatch reported today that Ohio could lose $26 billion under Trump Care. The Center for Community Solutions and an Ohio-based group revealed this in a new analysis. Is this above and beyond the Medicaid expansion cut?
No, that's all rolled together.
Okay.
And, you know, we focus on that because there's so many people and it's 700,000.
Exactly.
But there are additional ramifications in there. And frankly, there's some unanswered questions. So, you know, the Center for Community Solutions is a very good group, very reputable. I don't know, some critics might say that they're left-leaning, but their numbers are usually pretty good. That might not be exact, but certainly that's going to be the same story in many states like Ohio across the country. It's going to cost them huge dollars, and many millions of people are going to face losing coverage.
The per cap, there's something in the repeal and replace the Republican proposal on the table right now that calls for per capita funding caps. So it would even change the nature of how Medicaid is funded.
Yeah, in some ways, this goes clear back to when Medicaid was first enacted in the mid-60s as an entitlement. You're going back that far and changing some of the basis. So it sounds like it's not going to quite be an entitlement now. And frankly, that's going to affect states like Ohio, where we're a little bit older, we're a little bit less healthy, shall we say, than folks in other states. And if you leave coverage and come back on, then you're going to pay more. Just a whole set of ramifications, not only, again, for every state, but especially a state like Ohio.
And Policy Matters Ohio said, and more of a left-leaning organization, has said that Ohio will be forced to abolish Medicaid expansion because of the lower federal funding, that even if it wanted to, it just to pay the tab for those per capita funding caps and make up the difference, it would abolish the expansion.
Well, you wouldn't have to. I guess they're saying de facto you would have to. I mean, the alternative is coming up with, I say, at least $1.5 billion a year, probably more when all the other details are known. And, you know, one of the big unknowns is they're talking about making block grants to state, something, frankly, Governor Kasich favored on the presidential trail.
Right.
But it's not just any block grant. It's, you know, okay, what strings are going to be attached to those block grants? What exactly can we do with the block grant? And, of course, the bottom line is, how big is the block grant going
to be? And if there's any restrictions. And, you know, they always say block grants, and then they slap some restrictions on it.
Exactly, yeah.
That's the usual modus operandi.
I don't see how this legislature comes up with an extra billion or so dollars for Medicaid. I mean, the governor had to take this through controlling board to get the expansion approved in the first place. There are lawmakers who will say, look, we shouldn't be paying the bills for able-bodied single adults. They should go out and get jobs and cover their own bills. I don't see how this legislature does that.
Well, and keep in mind, again, we're talking about federal health care while the state is dealing with its own budget. The states where revenues keep coming in below estimates in the double digits. So the state of Ohio is already facing its own economic problem. And with its own budget, with tax shifting that this legislature says it's not going to approve, even though Governor Kasich proposed it. And to add this on top of it, I don't see how this doesn't become a huge mess here in Ohio in the upcoming months.
What are other groups saying in Ohio? The Ohio Hospital Association, we just heard the the head of the American Hospital Association on NPR this morning talking about a lot of these issues, saying it won't work. What is the Ohio, I mean, what are those kinds of stakeholders saying about this?
Well, the Ohio Hospitals Association was one of the bigger groups that came out in favor of Medicaid expansion when the governor was pushing it in the first place. And they've been out again saying that expansion needs to stay federally funded because of the emergency room visits, the visits that are covered. I think I saw, I don't want to misspeak, but I think I saw one report that said that one in four Ohio hospitals might have to close if Medicaid weren't expanded.
Especially rural hospitals, yeah, from what I understand, because their margins are so narrow.
Right, and, which is kind of ironic because a lot of rural hospitals were saying they were suffering under Obamacare, so they're maybe some separate things going on there. But, you know, I mean, if you have a patient on Medicaid, that's a sure payment. The government's picking up the tab, and you're not, you know, it's not a charity care case. It's not where you're maybe battling with a private insurer over, okay, how much are we going to compensate for this procedure, that procedure, and all that. You know, it's pretty set. So, you know, if I were a hospital, I would say that too. I believe the Children's Hospital Association has also spoken out against this. Certainly the AMA, the National Doctors Group, and I assume the OSMA, the Ohio Doctors Group, would fall in behind that. The AARP has come out against that, perhaps least surprisingly. So Chamber of Commerce has come out in favor of the House Republicans' plans in Washington, however.
I didn't know that. You know, I read an interesting statistic this morning from the Kaiser Family Health Kaiser Family Foundation, that 52, and this is in 2014, 52% of births in Ohio were Medicaid funded.
Hmm.
So you just think about.
Sure. One in three people.
And yeah, yeah.
Get
so there'll be some decisions
from,
to make.
From Medicare. So it's like, you know, frankly, for those of us fortunate enough to have employers who provide insurance, it's a world perhaps with which we're not familiar, but a whole lot of Ohioans are intimately familiar with this need.
State House Democrats have proposed a plan for a single-payer universal health care system in Ohio. Andy Chow, you're smiling about that, but you also reported about it, too. So tell us what the significance of that is and why you reported on something that probably isn't even going to get a hearing.
Well, the one question that I wanted to ask, the reason I really wanted to talk about it is because, of course, this is something that's just, like you said, it might not even get a hearing.
Yeah.
So Senator Mike Scandell from the Lakewood area, Senator Charlita Tavares from here in Columbus, they're co-sponsoring this bill. I think the big thing that they want to get out there is I think they want to be a voice for a group of people who are constantly calling for single payer. If you go, when we went to Bernie Sanders rallies, that was a huge hallmark of what they were calling for was single payer. When you go to these rallies now, these indivisible rallies, the progressives in the state want single payer. It's at the top of their priority
and
list.
And single payer, let's be clear, that's where pretty much you get rid of the middleman.
Yeah, you're just basically it's universal government funded healthcare. It's cycled through the government.
It's like Medicare, basically.
Yeah, right. It's Medicare for everybody. And I did not know this, but this is the eighth time that Senator Scandell has introduced this when he was in the House and now he's in the Senate. I think the big thing that he wanted to make clear is that he truly thinks that what did he say? He said that healthcare as we know it is about to crumble, and he thinks that single payer is the only way to go in the future.
Hmm. We're in that weird time of year where people keep reintroducing bills. That, mm-hmm. And as journalists, you know, as reporters, you know, you feel the need to, okay, I need to go out and report this. And then you see the headlines and you wonder whether readers are getting more confused than normal, you know, because that bill isn't going anywhere. It hasn't gone anywhere 10 times, right?
Right, right.
I mean, we still have to write about it. But it's just, I think sometimes we confuse people. When we have to do our jobs and we have to write about it.
As the president said, it's complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we are talking about this and that regarding whatever's happening in Washington that we can and whatever's going on at the State House as well. With my weekly reporters roundtable with us today, Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch, Ohio State House Bureau reporter for Gatehouse Media, and Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Still with us, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland, Gatehouse Media Ohio Statehouse Reporter Mark Kovac, and the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Reporter Andy Chow. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Last year, Governor Kasich vetoed another two-year freeze on the state's renewable energy standards. His fellow Republicans promised to return with another freeze. Apparently, they've taken that first step. What's up, Andy Chow?
Well, again, this is a group of conservative Republicans who just don't like these green energy standards. These are standards that require utilities to achieve a certain amount of renewable energy to put it on the grid. It doles out credits to renewable energy development groups. And what the Republican lawmakers say is that this kind of picks the winners and losers. This gives an unfair advantage to wind development, an unfair advantage to solar development, and in which case drives up the costs of those companies, of that power. And so they just want to get rid of it. They just want to repeal it. This is something that passed in 2008 with a lot of support, and now they want to get rid of it.
Well, of course, 2008, back in during the Strickland administration. Mm-hmm. But Governor Kasich kind of abided with the two-year freeze, but last year, put the kibosh on efforts to repeal it. Will he have that much control this time around, Daryl Rowland?
Well, he's still got the veto pen.
Yeah? Will he use it?
It's going to depend on what you, I mean, if they're just talking about abolishing it, it would be my opinion they probably would. Yeah. I mean, he has said that repeatedly. You know, the original standards he agrees with his Republican colleagues in the legislature are unrealistic. I'm not saying I agree with him or disagree with him, but there is agreement there. But to throw them out, he's not for. He just wants to roll them back a little bit, to not make the 25% by, you know, the middle of next decade, those goals and things like that, because he says that is unrealistic. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't want to throw the whole thing out. It's almost like the health care debate. He was against Obamacare, but he doesn't want to throw the whole thing out. Keep the good, throw out the what he views as the bad. Mm-hmm.
The argument here comes down to, does supporting green energy end up saving customers money or not saving customers money? At least that's what the Republicans are looking at. Other groups would look at,
is it helping the environment?
But there are studies that have come out and said, if you try to achieve this amount of renewable energy, you are in the long run going to help save Ohioans a lot of money. Yet there are other studies that say the opposite, that's going to drive up costs because of other ancillary things. And so you ask, will the governor veto a repeal? I think he absolutely would veto a repeal. The question is, does the House have enough votes to override a veto?
Right.
And does the Senate
That's
have? Right. And I think you're hearing a lot of people from the House, Republican Representative Bill Seitz from Cincinnati being kind of the key driver here. Mm-hmm. I think he really believes that the House has enough votes to override a veto. But I don't think the Senate does.
And you need both.
You need both.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like, as Andy and Mark were talking about earlier, it's like almost the irony of the governor being in Washington and sort of preaching to Congress, you got to work together. In this case, Republicans and Democrats. In Ohio, he can't even really get Republicans on the same page, even close to his own page, his own party. So many things in the budget, you know, his income tax. Here is tax shifting plan, the popularity of cutting the income tax yet again, his school funding plan. There's all sorts of things that are frankly almost certain to go down in flames here in the next couple of weeks.
And they've had no compunction about saying that.
Absolutely not. And again, with the huge majority that the Republicans have in the House, and of Republicans that are not necessarily like-minded Republicans, with John Kasich, there's a growing feeling of independence, quite frankly, from the governor. And he's viewed as kind of a lame duck. It's kind of his day has come and gone in the minds of some of those ornery folks over there.
Yeah,
I was just going to say, I was trying to go back and look for the vote count because, I mean, Republicans have had a supermajority in the House and Senate, but I think they only had like 56 votes on the energy bill in December, and they need 60 to override. So they didn't have the votes then.
But did they pick up some new members?
They picked up one. They pick up one or two.
Well, they have the Athens seat. They have
right.
One or two seats that, and so I think it's a matter of convincing two more votes, basically.
Yeah. But that bill, I think, is up for a first hearing on Tuesday afternoon, I think, in Sites. Sites is the chairman of the committee who will oversee it. So if nothing else, it'll be entertaining.
You know, Andy Chow, in that story you wrote and reported for Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau, you made the reference to the super minority.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
And you know what?
I
had never heard that. I actually read that. I stole that from somebody else who would use it. I think it was Chrissy Thompson from the Cincinnati Inquirer. But yeah, I guess if you have a super majority, then you're also part of a super minority.
On the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
Meaning an incredibly small minority.
Yeah. And so in the Senate, I believe the Democrats only have 9 members in a 33-member chamber. So that's definitely a super minority. And then on the flip side in the House, it's the same situation.
Yeah, which made me think, Daryl Rowland, about something you wrote about over the weekend a little bit about an analysis published in 538.com entitled Purple America Has All But Disappeared.
This is one of the most fascinating things I have read since the election, quite frankly, and I've read quite a lot of political analysis. This is almost like what I would call a geopolitical analysis in that it looks at, you know, some of the nuts and bolts of voting patterns. And we have noticed, you know, you talk about the divide, you know, I'll just talk about Ohio for now, between rural and urban Ohio and how that was evidenced in the vote between Trump and Clinton last November. But he starts comparing election to election and how things have evolved since 1992. Now, first a caveat, I question a little bit his being David Wasserman, who's the U.S. House editor for the Cook Political Report in Washington, Charlie Cook's newsletter. He starts with 92 as a baseline. Well, that was the year Perot was the strongest. Like in Ohio, he got, like, I think almost 1 in 5 voters. So the margins would have been a little bit smaller. But having said that, I think a central point remains in that we are much more polarized now. Okay, we've said that. But what he is seeing is polarization from county to county and from election to election. Let me give you an example. He basically measured 3 things. How many counties? And he uses counties because counties stay the same. They're not affected by annexation.
They can't redraw the lines.
Right. They're not affected by redistricting. So some of those, you know, all that kind of evens out over the years. Obviously, there's population coming and going across the country. He talks about extreme landslide counties where the winning candidate prevailed by 50 or more points. There were very few nationwide back in the early 90s, but you look at 2012 and especially 2016 in spades, there are so many more, such a high percentage. You look at the flip side of that coin is how many counties were decided by just a single digit. And again, we're talking about the presidential race. So, you know, back in 92 between Clinton and Bush 41, there were 303. I'm sorry, there were almost 1,100. So that's about a third of the 31, more than a third of the 3,100 counties. So last year, it was only 303. So it dropped from 1,100 to 300, the number of counties decided by single digit. I looked at Ohio to see if the trend was continued here in Ohio because, you know, we're kind of the quintessential purple state,
right?
The swing state, the bellwether state, battleground state, all those adjectives that we reporters like to throw around and say, hey, we're covering something important here. Again, in 92... if you look at, again, Ohio obviously has 88 counties, 37 of them were decided by single digits. So, you know, fewer than half, but, you know, fairly close to half. In 26, it was down to 8. So it went from, you know, 37 to 8 counties that were decided by single digits. And, you know, and the overall margin didn't really change that much. You know, the Clinton victory over Bush 41 in 92. You know, and Trump won by 8 points this past year. So it wasn't a huge swing in terms of the bottom line. So you might miss this. But, you know, this is part of what explains the Trump phenomenon. You look at some of those rural counties, especially like in Northwest Ohio, and we think, well, they're Republican before, they're Republican now. No story there. Mm-hmm. But you look at the margins. And, again, we're talking about supermajorities. I mean, what I would have turned to a supermajority before, you know, counties where the Republican candidate won in the 60s, as Mitt Romney did, as John McCain did, as Bush 43 did. You know, they were up in the 70s for Trump. And I think some of those counties, I think Keith Faber's from home county, for instance, up around the Salina area, I think went like 80% for Trump. So we focused a lot on the Mahoning Valley, rightfully so, but there's also a lot going on in Republican territories where the margins were going to these super landslides. So that explains, and that explains a saying that I know I heard a lot back during the campaign, maybe all of you did as well, is like, I don't know anyone who's voting for Trump, or I don't know anybody who's voting for Clinton, depending on where you were, because we've become politically segregated in this country and in the in this state. And I just found that a fascinating study.
Yeah, and I think it definitely goes beyond who you pick in, but and then it's just it's the arguments. There are just places where you don't hear the other side of an argument. And those bubbles that we live in Franklin County or in these other counties, it definitely seems like there's this disconnect between what we think and what other people think.
But the thing is, you know, we just were talking, Mark Kovac, about how rural hospitals could be hit the hardest if a plan like what the Republicans have introduced in Congress goes through to repeal and replace Obamacare. That is the places where 60, 70, 80% of voters supported Trump. Who supports this plan? I mean, it's a dichotomy, no?
I suppose. I don't know. I really don't know how to answer that.
I guess we'll have to see. Like I said earlier, this is where political rhetoric and policy making kind of hit where, okay, you said you're going to do this, but now I guess maybe these lawmakers are going to go back to their districts and talk about what plans are out there.
There is a... Are one in four hospitals really going to close? Are these rural hospitals really going to close?
That might be hyperbole, but the bottom line is a very high percentage of people who go to rural hospitals are covered by Medicaid.
Yeah. And so I guess when this stuff actually starts affecting them directly, maybe that will change their mind and they'll say, oh, wait a minute, this is not what I signed up for. This is not the kind of promise I heard when I was voting last time. But how long does it take for that to actually trickle down to where they're actually feeling it, you know,
and
in a personal way
and
make the connection that way? Mm-hmm.
Well, this is certainly an irony. I suppose Democrats may even say a delicious irony with all these. What do we have? Do we end up having 50 votes to repeal Obamacare? And now it's like, where's your replacement? And now your replacement looks like that. And, we're going to see Congressional Budget Office numbers probably today or tomorrow. That almost certainly is going to show it's going to cost more and cover fewer people. It's like, okay, is that what the whole replace Obamacare was about? But I think Mark and Andy are both right that this was part and parcel of the Trump campaign. And, of course, President Trump has now embraced the House plan and has promised to campaign for it. We saw Vice President Pence in Louisville.
Right.
And we saw preemptive strikes at the CBO numbers on the Sunday talk shows from the Trump administration. All those, you can't believe those. So, again, the campaign continues. Anything that's against us, you can't believe they're not credible. Whatever is going to be said in the tweets,
kind of like the jobs reports during the campaign. But now that that's all over,
now that they favor us, boy, that's just such a beautiful source.
Yeah,
and the bigger question is, skeptics of Trump and all the promises he's made about the jobs, about Obamacare replacement. You're going to love it. No details, but you're going to love it. Well, are people going to love it when they see what happens? And we'll see how good of a businessman, how good, perhaps more. To the point, how good of a salesman President Trump is. I mean, if Trump Care, Lord knows it's going to be called that. It's got to be Trump Care, or the first scandal is going to be something gate. when Trump Care takes effect and the immediate ramifications are negative where people live, what's the explanation going to be? Okay, is that going to be the media's fault? That's going to be kind of hard to push. I don't know. That's what we're going to be waiting to see. And if the jobs don't come back, as he said, who's the scapegoat going to be? So it's going to take some time for all this to work out. And, who knows? Trump Care may work. The jobs may come back. Mm-hmm. And, we'll have to have to turn the page on both those.
I think it should be said that right now we are seeing people from the Trump administration, such as Vice President Mike Pence, making a couple of promises like people will still be covered under a Medicaid expansion. It won't drive up costs. And we saw very similar promises from the Obama administration on several different fronts. Mm-hmm. Premiums won't go up as high as you think they are. You won't lose coverage. You'll be able to keep the health care coverage you have now. So I think what we're seeing is it's messy no matter what political party you're with. If you're trying to overhaul something like health care, it's messy on either end.
Here's what I'm afraid is going to happen. There's going to be this negative stuff that starts happening, and we as the media will be pointing out, you said you were going to do this, but now you're doing this. And there's a whole group of people out there who are tuning us out at this point or view us as the enemy. And they're going to say, well, Trump never said that. You know, you guys are making it up. And that's kind of the weird time we're living in, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so how much are people going to think back to the campaign and think, okay, Trump promised to do this and now he's not doing it? Or are they going to think,
You're just exaggerating.
Yeah. That's not really what he said. And we didn't think he was going to do that anyway. So, you know, you guys just stop trying to stir up trouble. I mean, that's kind of what I hear from just regular people out mm-hmm. there right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, the latter prospect is, you know, we don't care. That carried him through the campaign. All these things that, you know, so many people were just spinning in circles about the rude comments and all that. It turns out the majority in Ohio, at least, they didn't care, or at least did not care in comparison to the prospect for someone who's actually going to carry out the promise of changing Washington. Mm-hmm. They evidently voters made that balancing act, and all those rude remarks, the lies, the broken promises, or whatever, didn't matter. Because, my golly, Trump, he tells it like it is, and he's going to shake up Washington. You know what? He is shaking up Washington.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So, you know, all these dire warnings that we're talking about of the critics, I think that judgment is far, far from getting down to your typical Trump voter in a state like Ohio.
We will continue our conversation on our weekly Reporters Roundtable. You just heard from Daryl Rowland. He's public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Mark Kovac, Ohio State House Bureau reporter for Gatehouse Media, and Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. With me in the studio, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, Mark Kovac of Gatehouse Media, and Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. If you let's just start with this segment with the EPA issue. A federal budget proposal leaked last week, and it revealed plans by the Trump administration to cut the U.S. EPA budget by 25% and eliminate one out of every five jobs in the agency. The Dispatch reported that the Ohio EPA depends on federal funding for about a fifth of its budget, so cuts of that magnitude could affect the state of Ohio. How has Ohio EPA Director Craig Butler responded, Daryl Rowland?
Well, it's interesting. This was a story done by my colleague, Marianne Renault. About 20% of state EPA. So in terms of dollars and cents, you know, if there are funding cuts, that will have ramifications. But philosophically, Director Butler first warns it's very early and
be patient. Is
be patient. And, you know, frankly, I think many of these are from leaked documents, so they're probably legit, but, you know, we're not 100% there
right yet.
So Got to get some caveats out of the way before we start talking about this. But philosophically, I think, you know, he wants the state to be more that front-end enforcement end. I think that is part of the Republican mainstream that perhaps the Trump administration and EPA Director Pruitt have tapped into. Now, what they don't like, especially, is the cutbacks, and this is supposedly like a 90% cutback, of the Lake Erie protection money.
Right.
Stone Labs, I think, would close, and all those things we've been writing about, and the, you know,
and
the
Lake
problems
Erie
with
has
the algae.
Issues.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, so that will go down the tubes. And I've seen, frankly, bipartisan protestations from Republicans and Democrats in Ohio. Senator Portman has called that out. I think some of the Republican members of Congress who live along or represent areas along Lake Erie also pointed that out. So that has drawn a big red flag in Ohio from both sides.
So what do they want it both ways? They want the, you know, they're not going to get, I mean, the money's going to be cut. And by the way, again, we're talking about the federal cuts on top of probable state cuts or funding freezes, at least because of the state finances. Right?
Yeah. And
the Ohio EPA.
And keep in mind, whenever you go on the campaign trail and you listen to conservative speeches or you talk to the people who are at the rallies, one of the things that they want or one of the things that they kind of were okay with hearing is we need to abolish the EPA. We need to abolish the US EPA because it's become synonymous with regulation and either cutting jobs or driving up costs. And so there's a lot of people who think that the EPA is just an organization that creates onerous regulations that are needless. And that's the mentality there. But again, when it comes to actually trying to do something like that or cutting its budget by a lot, then you see that, oh, wait a minute, I thought I didn't like the EPA, but I also love Lake Erie and I don't want algae in there. I don't want Asian carp to take over. So you're right. It became this talking point where it became the symbol of regulation. But again, when we see it applied to things like Lake Erie, I think people are going to have a problem with it.
We'll be talking about all of this next hour. 2017 is supposed to be a banner year for walleye in Lake Erie, but there are concerns about the future of Lake Erie and the rest of the Great Lakes over potential budget cuts and apathy about the encroachment of Asian carp. We're going to talk fish next hour, so just give people a heads up on that. More news on the 2018 gubernatorial election front. Betty Sutton is the second Democrat to announce, and now we have a third.
Hot off the presses
early this morning, Connie Pillich announced her candidacy for governor in 2018. Of course, they have obviously we were talking about a primary cooking up here. Mm-hmm. Betty Sutton, let's talk about her first. Former three-term U.S. House member, four-term Ohio House member from the Akron suburbs. How does she stack up? I've heard she's got the most promising potential. Daryl?
Well, the Democrats, you know, it's all kind of relative. The Democrats are obviously in a huge hole here in Ohio. So there's no statewide Democrat. I mean, unless Sherrod Brown or something were to come back down and run. You know, in an administrative office, there's, you know, obviously no Democratic majorities in the House. So there's going to be kind of folks who have lost or people in relatively minor positions.
Betty Sutton, it should be said, was...
She was a three-term member of Congress. Republicans controlled the district, and they put her in the district with Jim Renacci up in the Akron area, and it was a very Republican district, and she was defeated. Mm-hmm. People around Columbus may not know Betty Sutton very well, but in Congress, if you heard of the Cash for Clunkers plan, that was basically her baby back during the Obama stimulus program era. While she was in the State House, I remember covering her. She was one who... went after some of the insurance companies for not covering certain areas. In fact, I wrote about
geographic regions.
No, no, okay. I'm sorry, area of malady or the type of treatment, like experimental treatment. I covered a woman with breast cancer. She had a double mastectomy because, like, her parents and her sisters had already died from breast cancer as a preemptive move, and still she got it. And for whatever reason, the insurance company at the time would not cover that. So she worked on legislation very hard in Ohio. I mean, this has been 10 or 15 years ago, at least, to try to get them to do that. And that's a cause that's sort of, you know, proven pretty popular over the years. So that's, you know, that's how people may have heard of Betty Sutton in this area. Mm-hmm. But that's going to be your number one problem of, you know, just getting known statewide. I mean, that's a problem with all three of these.
Yeah,
candidates.
if you look at the candidates right now, you have Joe Schiavone. He's an Ohio senator. He's the Senate Minority Caucus leader. Betty Sutton, Connie Pillich, who was an Ohio House member, but also ran for treasurer in 2014. All three of them don't really have high name recognition, and I think this might be naive to say, but I wonder if a tough primary might actually help these candidates get more name recognition, kind of get their name out there, put them in the forefront on the issues.
But I guess I wonder, can they even afford a tough primary? I mean, do they have enough money between them?
If they all don't have enough money, then maybe they can.
I wrote about a fourth governor Democratic candidate last week. I mean, he's local for me, but his name is Dave Kiefer. Uh-huh. He's a former Wayne County commissioner who was actually on the ballot as a Republican and a Democrat last year. I mean, you're getting really local, but I reported last week that
he's running for governor.
Wait,
you said he was on the ballot as a Republican and a
Democrat?
He ran
in the Republican primary for the State House, and then he ran as a Democrat for county commissioner last year.
Okay.
And so
strategic, I assume.
What's that?
Strategic, not forgetful.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I think he was pretty much a lifelong Republican. he's an interesting guy. He lost a leg in a motorcycle accident about 40 years ago. I think he holds a world record for pedaling a bicycle across the country time they do that. Anyway, he's local from one of my Worcester papers in Wayne County, but he says he's running, he's serious, and these folks are going to have a hard time keeping up with him. So remember that name, Dave Kiefer.
Okay. And another person to keep in mind is Nan Whaley, the mayor of Dayton, who I just heard last week that I believe she's running for re-election for mayor, but she is actually going to run unopposed. So that's going to free up some money that she maybe would have had to use in a re-election campaign. So maybe that's more of a boost for a possible statewide run.
And a sitting office holder.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say Nina Turner presents a fascinating potential candidate for governor. And I mean, she's got the energy and a national following at this point. She mm-hmm. could kind of shake up things that are going on there. I don't know what she's going to do. I mean, we're all speculating, but anyway.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say of Senator Schiavone and former Representative Pillage, Connie Pillage ran the most competitive Democratic race in 2014 statewide. She just lost to Josh Mandel. It's in single digits, I believe. That's one where a lot of Democrats say, if we weren't so weak at the top of the ticket with Ed Fitzgerald against Kasich, that, Connie may have come through and actually have been a statewide office holder. You talk about energy. You cover Democratic rallies. She would give a speech. She would sprint down from the stage and circle the audience two or three times, like giving high fives. She's an attorney. She's a former Air Force captain. So she has a pretty attractive resume. Senator Schiavone, over the years, has obviously grown to be respected in Democratic circles. He has some pretty intelligent pushback against some of Governor Kasich's proposals. He's very early on calling for charter school reforms and cleaning up that stuff, like we've seen with ECOT, to make them accountable. So that's kind of where the folks who have actually openly expressed an interest stand.
We have an email from Carl who asks, why not Michael Coleman or P.J. Sittenfeld? Of course, P.J. Sittenfeld ran... PG.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Paul George. Half the Beatles.
That's a good way.
He ran in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate, lost, and right as a good Democrat, immediately threw his support in with Ted Strickland, who lost in the general election. Michael Coleman, of course, former Columbus mayor, has said repeatedly he's not interested. So I don't know. P.G. Sittenfeld, I don't know if he's ready for primetime or not. What do you think?
Well, I haven't heard his name being thrown around that much, but I think he was a very interesting candidate when he was running for the Democratic primary. Somebody who just didn't really, I think it's fair to say he just didn't get respect from his own party with the Democrats, because the Democrats came out very early to endorse the other candidate in the primary, which was Ted Strickland. And because of that, he didn't even get a chance to run in a primary and get his name out there as much as he could have to kind of build up his own credibility. And he's a young city council member from
Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm. So it would be interesting to see what he does. But again, he doesn't have very high name recognition.
And I was told, this is one of these deals where a Republican gets you aside and, don't just take a grain of salt, take the whole shaker. But he maintained that Republicans were much more afraid that Sittenfeld would challenge Portman than Governor Strickland, because they knew, and frankly, Senator Portman, told me like a year ago, they knew as soon as they aired all those ads against Ted Strickland's record as governor, again, some people might view them as very unfair ads on the job losses during the midst of the Great Recession, but they just hammered that home. And Ted Strickland didn't really stand much of a chance. Didn't help himself a whole lot either. But PG, was a guy from a guy of ideas, an Ivy League grad, all that kind of a a young up-and-comer. But I agree. I've not heard him mention this context. Former Mayor Coleman, I think he's content to be where he is right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe make some money after serving a lot of years on Columbus City Council and then as Columbus's longest-serving mayor.
Right.
Have we mentioned Rich Cordray? That's a whole saga in itself at the federal level.
We have not mentioned Rich Cordray.
Right.
But what do you think? I mean, if he can keep his job for however long he can keep it.
Well, that's the whole subplot now, right? Is Trump letting him keep his job to keep him out of the governor's race here. So,
surprisingly, they haven't gone after that particular job yet.
Well, it's been mentioned, and when Trump had the bankers in, was that just last week or the week before?
This is with the
Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Yeah, right.
Rich Cordray, the former county treasurer here in Franklin County, former state treasurer, former attorney general. Mm-hmm. Appointed by President Obama to that current office, the first and only director of that office. His term, in theory, runs through, through next year. I know it runs into next year. So if he would serve out his term, there would be no practical way he could run for governor.
Right.
And he is, he has been on the statewide ballot. Now, frankly, Rich has a mixed track record of electoral success. If you've covered one of his campaigns, he's not the most natural campaigner. At least he was not then. Mm-hmm. But you look at some of the stuff the consumer office, if you just want to talk about saving people, frankly, billions of dollars from fraud and payday lenders and, college loans and all that stuff, he can point to a lot of stuff that his office has done, which is part of the reason why, some of the business interests want to get rid of him. But we have the whole strategy of where, as I was starting to say, Trump voiced a concern about the office and about Rich Cordray. I think it was last week when the community bankers were in.
Okay.
About how, we got to get to that. So it's just, is this 10th
lots
on his agenda, 1,010th?
If Cordray were to get in the race, and this is a huge hypothetical, but if it were Cordray against Republican Mike DeWine, it would be a rematch of 2010 when they ran against each other for attorney general. And I believe that year when the Republicans swept, that was the closest race. And Cordray brings something to the table that he's not a dynamic, energetic person, but he's very smart. And it would be interesting to see what he could bring to the table in a race of ideas.
And I think he's an energetic person. He just doesn't appear energetic. He's on the hustings, on the stump. He's comes across very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's right.
He's not a screamer. He's
quite the contrary.
Right.
But I don't know. By 2018, people may want someone that's a little more boring and a little more sedate. Hmm. Perhaps projects some competence and knows what he's doing. I don't know. Just spitballing here.
Yeah.
I don't know. After last year's campaign, I think maybe they're going to want more yelling and screaming.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. But after that last year's campaign, I know a lot of journalists are skittish about predicting anything.
Oh, yeah, you're not going to, I don't think you'll hear any of us, hey, we'll talk about Mark's friend in Wayne County. Oh, yeah. Randy, you want to run? Hey, you'd have a great chance, What the heck?
What has it done to us?
talk about the singed moth here in the press corps. Yeah. But speaking of the Republicans, they're going to have an interesting choice on, as every prominent Republican has in the country, how close do you want to be wedded to Donald Trump? Mm-hmm. How do you answer when those reporters are going to come asking, what do you think of Trump? What do you think of this tweet? What do you think of the health care plan? What do you think of this, that? He's going to define, for better or worse, much of their race. Mm-hmm. And they're going to make that call. And now you got someone like Josh Mandel seeking to run against Sherrod Brown next year for that U.S. Senate seat. Clearly has wedded himself to the whole Trump theme, the whole radical Islamic terrorists and all that. Just look at his Twitter feed. He has embraced that fully. We'll see what the Republicans do.
All right. Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Also, Mark Kovac, Ohio State House Bureau reporter for Gatehouse Media. Thanks, Mark, for joining us. Thanks, Daryl, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.